stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I am G. Abili reporting. In Colombia, rescuers are sorting through mounds of debris and mud Sunday in search of missing people. A massive wall of water from three overflowing rivers in Colombia swept through the region overnight Friday, destroying homes and infrastructure and killing about 200 people. Shortly after the banks of the rivers burst, a landslide followed, devastating the southwestern town of Mocoa. President Juan Manuel Santos visited the wrecked town of 40,000 near the border with Ecuador. Santos said the government will do everything possible to help families, not only the families who lost their loved ones, but all of those who lost their homes. The United States and Egypt are expected to reach accord on enhanced collaboration in the fight against radical Islamic terrorism Monday. That's when President Donald Trump is scheduled to host his Egyptian counterpart Abdel Fattah el-Sisi at the White House. In advance of the visit, the White House praised el-Sisi's tough policy in battling terrorists. The Oval Office meeting will be closely watched in Cairo, where there is intense curiosity about Trump's intentions toward Egypt and the greater Muslim world. Witnesses and relatives in southern Afghanistan say a pre-dawn bomb explosion killed at least 10 civilians, mostly children and women, in an area where Afghan National Security Forces were conducting anti-Taliban operations. It was not immediately clear whether an airstrike by government forces or an insurgent armed retaliation caused a deadly explosion Sunday in Helmand Province. This is VOA News. Famine is devastating parts of South Sudan. Aid agencies say an influx of South Sudanese refugees into Uganda is straining its food resources. Jill Crane has more.
Uganda has taken about half of the more than 1.5 million South Sudanese people who have fled into neighboring countries, as South Sudan has become Africa's largest refugee crisis, resulting from more than 3 years of civil war. As the refugees flee conflict, sexual violence, looting, and food insecurity, highlighted by the recent announcement of famine in two counties of Unity State, they're finding that aid agencies are struggling to provide them with enough food in the Ugandan refugee settlements. The government of Uganda and UNHCR, the UN's refugee agency, work with humanitarian organizations to coordinate the refugee response at the border entry points, providing clean water and medical screenings that include examining children for malnutrition and providing high-energy biscuits for people who are likely malnourished. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
A new study finds a steep increase in the number of women dying from drug overdoses around the world, and it also finds women are more severely punished than men for the use of drugs. Lisa Schlein has more.
The report finds governments do not pay enough attention to the huge and growing problem of drug abuse among women. The International Narcotics Control Board, which monitors implementation of UN international drug control treaties, says women get short shrift when it comes to the enactment of gender-sensitive policies. INCB President Werner Sipp tells VOA one-third of global drug users are women, but only one-fifth receive treatment. He says there tends to be a gender bias against women, as they often are punished more harshly for drug-related offenses than men. The report calls for alternative measures to punishment and conviction for minor drug crimes among women. It recommends more investment in treatment and rehabilitation programs, education, and social integration. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley said Sunday, President Donald Trump has not blocked her from attacking Russia. The comment comes as Mr. Trump continues to assail domestic news media for its reporting on congressional and legal investigations into whether his aides colluded with Moscow to help him win the election. Russian police arrested about two dozen protesters Sunday in Moscow, a week after more than 1,000 others were detained during a large-scale rally organized by a leading critic of President Vladimir Putin. The Russian state news agency TASS reports that Sunday's arrests were made in Moscow. I'm
That's
Gia Abili in Washington.
News from VOA. Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
I think this is mostly a time for people to reflect on difficulties we're facing now with regard to the implementation of the December 31st, 2016 agreement.
Congolese President Joseph Kabila plans to address Parliament Monday.
By the Constitution also, when you dissolve Parliament, it's within 90 days you conduct an election. There is no way we allow them as opposition to use that particular section of the Constitution to extend their stay in power.
The Sierra Leonean Parliament debates extending presidential term limits.
In the Central African Republic, during late 2012, 2013, 100 schools were damaged, destroyed or looted, 2 dozen used for military purposes.
And groups gather in Argentina for the second international conference on safe schools. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The main opposition coalition in the Democratic Republic of Congo has called for a nationwide stay-at-home protest beginning Monday. This, the group says, is aimed at forcing President Joseph Kabila to implement the December 31, 2016 agreement. The strike comes as local media reports that President Kabila plans to address Parliament Monday to outline measures to help resolve the country's political crisis. Freddy Mbuyamu Matungulu is the leader of the opposition Congo Nabiso Party, or ACONGO in the local Lingala language, for reaction in the DRC capital, Kinshasa.
Well, I think this is mostly a time for people to reflect on the difficulties we're facing now with regard to the implementation of the December 31st, 2016 agreement. As you know, this was a very important development in the political situation in the country here, in our attempts to get out of the political crisis in which we are. Unfortunately, we haven't seen a lot of progress since the signing of that agreement on December 31st.
Freddie, we understand there are reports that President Joseph Kabila will be speaking on Monday to outline some of his visions to resolve this political crisis. What are your expectations as a prominent member of the Rassemblement?
Well, I think we'll have to wait and see what the president puts on the table. What is certain is that as the Rassemblement, we want to see this political crisis resolved as soon as possible. I think the agreement embodies some of the expectations, the most important for the people of this country, who have spoken loud and clear. They want the Constitution to be respected. And most importantly, I think they want the presidential election held as soon as possible. And for us to get there, we need to make sure that this agreement is implemented as soon as possible.
But talking about the agreement and the subsequent talks that are spearheaded or mediated by the Catholic bishops, there are some sticking points in that the president wants the three candidates to be presented so the president can choose the prime minister, whereas the Rassemblement is insisting on choosing one. People are blaming the Rassemblement for why not just meet this demand so the process could move forward instead of stalling it, they said. What do you say to that?
Well, I think what's important is for this agreement to be implemented as soon as possible. And I think for that, we need a lot of understanding, some flexibility, certainly, on the part of everybody involved. And I'm hoping that we'll be in a position to achieve that this coming week.
What if in the president's speech to Parliament tomorrow, he issues out a deadline by which he expects the Rassemblement to present three candidates for him to choose the next prime minister as part of an effort to resolve this crisis and move the country forward towards elections, as you said, because if this is not done, he might continue to be in office and the agreement could be in trouble.
My hope is that, we'll see this stalemate broken, that a new prime minister is appointed very soon. We need to move forward. I think, we were talking about 12 months to implement this agreement and to take the people to the election. We've already wasted the whole first semester of the year, so we now only have 9 months left. And I think we ought to be focusing on finding ways to get out of the stalemate as soon as possible. And that's what I'm expecting, and that's what I'm hoping for this coming week.
Freddy Mbuyamu Matungulu is the leader of the opposition Congo Nabiso Party, Congo in the local Lingala language. He spoke with me from Kinshasa. The Cameroonian government has outlined new measures aimed to resolve the crisis in the English-speaking parts of the country. At a news conference in the capital Yaoundé, Justice Minister Laurent Esso said President Paul Biya answered concerns of the Anglophone lawyers by instructing the amendment of the organization and functioning of the Supreme Court with provisions for the inclusion of the common law section. For reaction, I'm joined in the studio by barrister Harmony Bobka Mbuton, president of the Northwest Lawyers Association in Cameroon. How are you, Barrister Harmony?
I'm good.
So what is your take on the concerns, ostensibly, as the government is saying, addressed by President Paul Biya about your concerns, English Lawyers Association in English-speaking parts of Cameroon?
They have not even started scratching the surface of the demands that we put forth on the 9th of May 2015. Just the delay alone has allowed the demands exclusively made by lawyers to metamorphose in a general revolution of the southern Cameroonians who have been under a second colonization by a sister African country. Although indeed this sister African country is just a mask that France, their own former colonial master, is wearing to exploit the resources in southern Cameroon. And to do this, they've had to completely apply the most corrosive quality of the principle of the theory of assimilation, that is, destroy our identity totally, both our own original African identity, plus what we, through our initial colonization, took, accepted, and adapted to our own circumstances from the British people.
Let me ask you this. You recently wrote that the revolution has continued to be fueled by the defiance of southern Cameroonians within their homeland and the committed support of compatriots in the diaspora. The government calls you guys agitators, conspirators, aim to undermine the social unity and integrity of the country. Your take.
You see, they have the government of the Republic of Cameroon, which I say is a Gaullist government.
Why the Gaullist government?
Because you remember the French leader, they mm-hmm. call him the last great Frenchman, Charles de Gaulle. I mean, he came up with this theory of governance where the centrality of power in the presidency was primordial. In fact, it lends itself very easily to the development of a presidential monarchy. And this is exactly the experience we've had in Cameroon. And what we are saying is that the government of Cameroon, in pursuit of its policy, that at best we are the lesser people in Cameroon, does not recognize what they pretended and promised to us as we were coming up to independence, that we are coming to join them and form a federation of two states of equal status. This they have completely rubbished. And there has been a quiet genocide, not only on the peoples of Southern Cameroon, but even on their values.
Now, the issue of genocide, they said it's been overstated, and the definition itself is being butchered. And there's nothing like genocide, and that the government is only arresting those who are agitators, who are creating disaffection and disunity in Cameroon.
We can prove it. And the challenge we are giving the government of the Republic of Cameroon that has a contrary theory is that they should lift the shutdown on internet. Because with internet, we were able to communicate the activities of government security forces in Southern Cameroon that proved beyond doubt that they were engaged in a genocidal operation in Southern Cameroon.
But the Minister of Information, Issa Chiroma Bakare, that I spoke with, said the agitators, including you, used WhatsApp and other social media platforms to organize, to disseminate false information, to create disaffection. And that, they said, is wrong because they are mandated by the Constitution to not only protect life and property, but to also ensure cohesion, of which, they said, you are bound to destroy. So they need to prevent that.
No, the Constitution itself is something to put to question. I will get back to that. But you have to understand, you cannot be a party to a dispute and be a judge in that dispute at the same time. The government is a disputant on one side against Southern Cameroonians. And we had taken the matter to the African Commission in Communication 266/2003. The African Commission gave a decision in favor of the Southern Cameroonians. And as a solution, they requested the government of Cameroon to invite us to sit on the dialogue table and work out a solution. This is way back. And the Cameroon government, I happen to have been one of the lawyers in that process. The Cameroon government said, give us time, let's organize ourselves and so on. But they just bought time to walk away from the advice of the African Commission. So what they are saying, qualifying what was being sent out through WhatsApp and other social media, is their judgment. I want to be fair that it is not any of the disputants who are competent to determine whether what was posted was true or false. It requires a third party mediator or facilitator of a dispute resolution process where they will objectively determine which of the postings on WhatsApp was false and which was not false. And I continue to say that, even as we speak, can Cameroon government give an explanation, the motive for shutting down internet, if they were not carrying out what we are accusing them of doing, which violates all their engagements? I mean, all their engagements.
No, Barrister Harmony, yeah. Some of your colleagues have been arrested and others have been forced into exile or overseas, including you.
Like myself, yeah.
Now, what made you flee and what's next? Because the Cameroon government is saying that some of you guys were caught red-handed and they will be prosecuted, you know, to the full extent of the law. And that is why you are running away.
No, not at all. I can tell you, in December, a warrant of arrest was issued for my apprehension. At the same time, or subsequently, I mean, a few days after that, the President of the Republic requested a longtime friend of his, who is a business mogul in French-speaking sub-Saharan Africa. He's the richest person in French-speaking sub-Saharan Africa, Alhaji Baba Dampolo, who incidentally had been my client at some point, that you are a businessman in the Northwest region, you are an elite, you definitely would know this gentleman they call Barrister Harmony Bobka. Can't you reach out to him and find out exactly what the problems of the lawyers are so that we can look into them? And Alhaji Baba invited me to come discuss the matter with him. And I told him, this is not a personal matter of Bobga. It is a matter of the lawyers and eventually the whole community. So we put this team together. Unfortunately, my colleague Nkongo Felix Agbobala, who is facing treason charges now in Yaounde, he lost his father 2 hours before we took off for Bamenda from Boya. And I and another colleague who was president of Manu Lawyers Association, Emilien Ganjo, we went there, including the Secretary General of the University Lecturer Syndicate in Boya, Dr. Fontem Neba. And
well, Fontem faces charges as well. He
yes.
was arrested recently.
Yeah. We'll but come we, back. We went together to Ndawara, met Alhaji Baba, and we maintained our demands. And this is where the trick is. In our demands, I presented the keynote presentation at our inaugural conference.
Barrister Harmony, we don't have time. We need to go, but we will come back to that shortly.
Right.
That was Barrister Harmony Bobga Mbutton, president of Northwest Lawyers Association in Cameroon. He joined me here at the VOA studios in Washington, D.C. The main opposition Sierra Leone People's Party, or SLPP, has sharply condemned what it says are tactics by the government to extend President Ernest Bai Koroma's stay in office. This as two opposition rebel parliamentarians tabled a measure that seeks to extend the ongoing voter registration. It could also see the term of parliament and by extension the president lengthened. President Koroma's second and final term ends in 2018. For reaction, I reached opposition SLPP parliamentarian Dixon Rogers.
We've told them that that is not going to be possible because according to the Constitution, Section 85.5, it is very clear on that, that the life of this parliament will come to an end on the 7th of December. And by the Constitution also, when you dissolve parliament, it's within 90 days to conduct an election. So there is no way we allow them as opposition to use that particular section of the Constitution to extend their stay in power.
Does the opposition have the numerical power to challenge this move to remove term limits?
We don't have the numerical strength, but it's not about numbers. It's about the Constitution. Because Section 85 of the Constitution is an entrenched clause. So there is no way you have to tamper with it without going through a referendum. We agree that the president has several occasions bastardized the national constitution by removing the vice president and by amending the constitution to have another speaker. But those sections of the constitution were not an entrenched clause. But Section 85 is an entrenched clause, so will not allow them, will not accept them.
This will not be the first time an African head of state made the move to remove term limits. So it is not uncommon for this to happen. APC members are saying the president is popular, he's transformed the country, and that he needs more time to improve the living conditions. That is why they support the move. What do you say to that?
And that is wrong assumption. The president is not as popular as they think. Secondly, it is not about being popular. Otherwise, the late president, Tijan Kaba, will have run another third term. It's just that they have majority in parliament. So whether he's popular or not, we have to obey the constitution. I can tell you for free that he has lost popularity in this country. He has lost popularity in the, within the international community. Therefore, we as opposition, we stand tall against any attempt for the ruling party to extend their term in office.
What moves specifically are you going to implement to prevent this from happening, as you said?
What is important is that the citizens of this country are no longer ready for any bastardizing of our constitution. I mean, if you were in Parliament on Thursday, you would see the parliamentary gallery was full of the press, NGOs, and the civil societies when they had the information that they want to bring a motion that we extend our term of office. Now, there are two motions. One of the motions was moved by Honorable Swallow, and I seconded the motion. Now, what they wanted to do by the Constitution Section 38 tells us that when once there is boundary delimitation, or alteration, that has to be approved by Parliament. Now, when they did the new boundary limitations, they did not bring the bill to Parliament for us to pass it. But the National Electoral Commission had sent the instrument to the Law Officers Department since November, deliberately and calculatedly they did not bring their instrument to parliament. So that after the registration, during the exhibition, which will be in November, they will come and say, no, all what NEC has done is wrong. They are supposed to bring these instruments to parliament. They did not bring it. They would have used that provision, one, to nullify the whole registration and put another date for registration, whereby extending their term in office.
How has been the reaction of Sierra Leoneans following news to table this motion of amending the constitution to allow President Ernest Bai Koroma to seek another term?
If you walk in the street of Freetown, for every 10 people we interview, 8 to 9 will tell you that, no, we are not ready for extension. We are tired with this government. The inflations are very hard. The leon has depreciated so much against the dollar that we live on less than $1 a day in this country. So people are no longer ready to extend the time of this government and to vote for this government come 2018.
Dixon Rogers is an opposition parliamentarian from the Sierra Leone People's Party, or SLPP. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. This past week, government ministers and education-oriented NGOs gathered in Argentina for the second International Conference on Safe Schools. The meeting was sponsored by the international charity Education Above All and its program called Protecting Education in Security and Conflict. It seeks international support for the Safe Schools Declaration, which aims to protect schools from attack in conflict areas. So far, 60 states have signed the non-binding document. VOA's William Eagle spoke with an academic advisor to the charity, Maleya Malik, about the impact of attacks on children.
Attacks on education and military use of school impacts on hundreds of thousands of children. Just to give you a couple of examples from Africa, in the Central African Republic during late 2012, 2013, 100 schools were damaged, destroyed or looted, 24 used for military purposes, and a recent assessment in the country found that 30% of schools had been attacked. South Sudan, for example, 31% of schools have been attacked, and we know that there have been 273 separate cases of attacks around the country in the great Upper Nile region.
Tell us more about the Safe Schools Declaration. How many countries have signed so far, and what does it suggest that they do?
It's an intergovernmental political commitment which allows states to join up and commit to taking sensible actions, really common sense steps, to make it less likely that students, teachers, universities will be attacked. And the measures include providing assistance to victims of attack, promoting conflict-sensitive approach. Probably in Africa, the most important measure is a guideline to protect schools and universities from military use, because school buildings are a really valuable asset during a conflict, which are used by both the state and armed non-state actors. It's a very important way in which attacks to education can be prevented, and we can take sensible steps to make sure that children who are living during armed conflict and during insecurity can have access to education. Just to give you some figures, there's been fantastic momentum building up in time for Argentina, so that we now have France joined in February, Canada has joined. We're hoping there'll be other countries joining. We're in about 60 countries at the moment, and we're hoping that that'll increase up to 100 sometime soon. In terms of African countries, it's quite a good list, actually, not comprehensive, but Angola's a member, Chad, Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya, Niger. Nigeria is very significant because of attacks on education in Boko Haram. But also Somalia, South Sudan are also signatories. And so there is quite a good momentum, quite a good list of African countries who I think are members.
Is there any outreach to non-state actors in terms of having them interested or signing the Safe Schools Declaration?
There's an organization called Geneva Call, based in Geneva, that's done fantastic work in reaching out to armed non-state actors, including armed non-state actors in Africa and the sub-Saharan Africa. And they had a conference last year where half a day was devoted to working with armed non-state actors, informing them about the Safe Schools Declaration, but also informing them about the practical measures they can take to make sure that they don't recruit children under their control into armed groups, that they try and make sure that children are safely handed over to agencies such as UNICEF or Save the Children, and to make sure they respect children who are under their control as children, rather than trying to use them as an asset of war.
That was Maleya Malega, an advisor to the International Charity Education Abbeville. She spoke with viewers William Eagle. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from African Collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. And good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. We begin in football, where FIFA is proposing that Africa gets 9 automatic places when the World Cup expands to 48 teams in 2026. That would be an increase from the tally of 5 places that the continent currently holds. The 10th African country will take part in a six-nation playoff tournament to decide the last 2 spots. This was agreed upon by FIFA President Gianni Infantino and the 6 Continental Confederations presidents in a meeting in Zurich on Thursday. If ratified, Africa will get 4 more slots added to the current 5 of the 32-team competition and will take effect at the 2026 FIFA World Cup. The new 48-team competition has 46 direct slots. The 2 other slots will be decided after a playoff tournament between 6 teams, with each one from a confederation except UEFA, and one additional team from the confederation of the host country. Meanwhile, new Confederation of African Football President Ahmad has given his support to Morocco over a potential bid to host the 2026 World Cup. The North African country has bid to host the finals on 4 previous occasions, but missed out on the 1994, 1998, 2006, and 2010 editions. Ahmad was elected CAF chief, replacing Issa Hayatou on March 16th. His backing of Morocco comes only a few months after FIFA president Gianni Infantino declared that the country has the necessary infrastructure and organizational capacity to host the World Cup. South Africa's hosting of the tournament 7 years ago is the only other time the event has been played on the African continent. In athletics, Kenya's duo Matthew Kisoroi and Pamela Jepkosgei Rotich took top honors at the Daegu International Marathon on Sunday. While Jepkosgei waited until the final few meters to break free from her last remaining opponent, Kisoroi ran alone for much of the final 5 kilometers, on his way to winning in 2 hours, 7 minutes and 32 seconds. This was Kisoroi's second fastest time of his career and just 41 seconds shy of the course record. Peter Somme came in second, Reda placed third, and Kipsang held on to fourth. In the women's race, Jepkosgei was rewarded with a personal best of 2:27.52. Kiptoi and Koech also set personal bests in third and fourth, running 2:28.39 and 2:29.30 respectively. Ukraine's Olga Kotovska was fifth in 2:30.18. And in Europe, Kenya's Jocelyn Jepkosgei broke 4 world records at the Sportsimo Prague half marathon when winning the IAAF Gold Label Road Race in 1:04.52 on Saturday. The 23-year-old, competing in just her 5th half marathon to date, also smashed the world records for 10 kilometers, 15 kilometers, and 20 kilometers en route to her victory. Jepchumba finished second in 1:05.22, 29 seconds quicker than her winning time from last year. Fancy Chemtai, whose only known performance so far was a 32.21 clocking over 10 kilometers in Kericho last year, made a stunning breakthrough in third place after passing through 5 kilometers in 15.16 and 10 kilometers in 30.56 She went on to finish in 1 hour, 6 minutes and 58 seconds. With Kenyans taking all the top 5 places, Valerie Ayabai and Gladys Chasha finished 4th and 5th, respectively. US's Jordan Heisei clocked a lifetime best of 107.55 in 6th place. Although no records were broken in the men's race, Tamirat Tola's victory was just as convincing. The Olympic 10,000 meters bronze medalist was part of a large leading pack that went through the first 5 kilometers in 14.22. The Ethiopian still had 9 other men for company as he passed the 10-kilometer mark in 28.31, but he gradually pulled away from the field soon after. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. Meanwhile, I still have Barrister Harmony Bobka-Button, president of the Northwest Lawyers Association in Cameroon. You were finishing your thoughts about the meeting you had with an emissary of the government about concerns of the Cameroon, the English-speaking Cameroonian lawyers. Could you finish your thoughts kindly, please?
Well, I must add here that that emissary received the raw disposition of the Southern Cameroon lawyers, as well as that of the teachers who had joined us. Mm-hmm. And because we have been under, suppression and occupation for more than 55 years after the date which was projected for our independence, the whole community rallied on that platform that the lawyers had launched, and we were all on the strike. We were firm that even if they granted the demands of the lawyers and those of the teachers, we needed further assurance that this were going to be sustainable, because there is always a clawback strategy. Like the press conference of the Minister of Justice on the 31st.
Laurent Esso.
Mm-hmm. Everything he said, if you go to the concluding part of his press statement, there was a total clawback, total, which put us in a worse situation than when we were just before the strike
began. So what's the best way forward to resolve this impasse?
The best way forward, first, is that the government begins to deconstruct the instruments of oppression, particularly the internet shutdown, because you would be taking a risk to trust somebody who has been in power for 34 years and is planning to run elections next year. That is Mr. President Paul Biya. And we have argued that you cannot invite the Southern Cameroonians to dialogue, whether it's just the lawyers or the teachers or other professionals or the entire community, and then you shut down the place from the public view, not only national view, but international view. That's why the international community does not understand. They have a singular opportunity, for example, through this program, to know from somebody coming from the ground that this is the reality. And it is not for Cameroon government to prescribe what is correct and what is not correct, what is false and what is not false. But let me conclude by saying this. The situation in Southern Cameroon took 55 plus years to get this bad. I am cognizant of the fact that it's not going to take us 1 year, 2 years to deconstruct that evil. And therefore, on both sides, we must show good faith. And we have shown it by embracing non-violent approach to conflict resolution. But the government has adopted a violent way of crushing armless, peaceful protesters. The soldiers who are trained to fight Boko Haram terrorism in the north and the equipment have simply been transferred into the northwest and southwest regions that made up the Southern Cameroon. And these are being used with sponsorship and support from foreign friends including the United States.
Well, Barrister Harmony, we'll come back in at a later date to delve deeper into the concerns of Southern Cameroonians.
That was Barrister. Please, but let us continue to drum the fact that they need to lift this internet shutdown so that we can trust the government in discussing this.
We will come back to that. That was Barrister Harmony. Bobcam Mbutton, president of Northwest Lawyers Association in Cameroon. He joined me here at the VOA studios in Washington, D.C. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback of with music from the continent.
Music and Taliban number one. Every night and day I just give a lot of thanks and praises to my teacher. Nigga, I want a fair body, me need be your baby girl. I think back in the car to get you, baby. And only your go shop. And meet you by what you are keen to the beach. Come on, and that can buy me, baby. Check your body out. Not the time to dance, not the time to the best. Hey, man, this kind of music, you go just the dance slow and steady, you know, to give you stress. Anything where I be today, now, Baba God, yeah. Oh, the goodness and mercies which I hope I give to me, you make me happy, yeah. Happy days, happy days. Happy days, happy days. Happy days, happy days.
Just they dance slow and steady, we don't give you stress.
Anything where I be today, na Baba God.
All the goodness and mercies which Jehovah they give to me, they make me happy. Happy is happy. Happy is happy. Happy make me happy.
Oh my gosh. Okay, see. Ijiburuku wa tojo yada for toti na tele. Koni ale mi mo. Aye ni mu ni mu ni mu ni mu. Ah, ama ni mu mama. Taba shere dele iyo. Taba lo shiwa uwe ma ni biwa mo. Taba ni biti mo ti demo. Taba yekwe jona mo ni ni mo.
Jehovah Jah.
Onu wa mi oba toto di arere o.
Igi igi oba mi.
Atopi ju ale wile she o.
Jehovah Jah.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. While President Joseph Kabila of the Democratic Republic of Congo and his close supporters are desperately trying to wiggle out of the agreements on transition and power sharing brokered by the Catholic Church last year, the Security Council decided last Friday to reduce the strength of its largest peacekeeping force in the world, MONUSCO, from its total strength, 19,000, by 3,000. There have been reports in the media that member states in the Security Council, particularly the United States, are worried about the enormous cost of the peacekeeping force in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It should be borne in mind that the cost to permanent members of the Security Council is related to their permanent status. This commentator was deeply involved in 1973-74 when the formula for the cost to member states of the UN was being prepared. It was agreed that because of the enormous power and influence of the five permanent members, United States, United Kingdom, France, Russia, and China, that they should bear a greater share of the cost of peacekeeping. Secondly, one should take into account that the current attitude of the United States to UN peacekeeping is not new. In 1992, following the debacle of the U.S. forces in Somalia, then President Clinton decided to withdraw all U.S. forces from the Somalia peacekeeping force and also issued a presidential statement that the U.S. would no longer support United Nations peacekeeping. That changed when the circumstances changed, and the U.S. became an enthusiastic supporter of peacekeeping, particularly on the African continent. Now, it is also important to note that the U.S. can drastically reduce its cost for peacekeeping by giving up its status as a permanent member. Of course, that will not happen. It could also drastically reduce its cost for peacekeeping if it supports the call by the African states and others to expand the number of permanent members by 5 to about 10. For the last 25 years, some of the permanent members have refused to accept that proposal. So when one talks about the cost of peacekeeping to the United States, one must take all these factors into account. Now, returning to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, one should not mistake that it is a popular force in the DRC. In fact, the majority of Congolese consider MONUSCO as ineffective. Furthermore, in previous years, the government of the Congo, President Kabila, had called for the withdrawal of MONUSCO. It has been the Security Council that has been felt compelled to maintain it because, whatever you may say, MONUSCO has contributed to the peace and tranquility of the Congo. Now, what will be the implication of the reduction of the force? It will take time to reach the agreed new strength of MONUSCO. In the meantime, it is an obligation on the part of the international community, which includes the African Union, to impress on President Kabila and his supporters to accept the arrangement for the transitional government. The problem now is that President Kabila is refusing to accept the candidate put forward by the Rassemblement for the premiership of the DRC. This they must accept. Otherwise, the debacle will continue and the consequences of the turmoil. For example, the opposition had called for a major demonstration tomorrow, and one does not know what the consequences of the clash between this demonstration and the government forces will be. So one must understand the decision of the Security Council, but also the international community must redouble its efforts to put pressure on President Kabila to complete this agreement brokered by the Catholic Church. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Michael Dubinsky, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, pretend you are dead and you will see who really loves you. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Cape Verde is a country made up of 10 volcanic islands 300 miles off the northwest coast of Africa. It has few natural resources, and only about half of the islands are suitable for farming. But it has lovely mountains, warm waters, and beautiful beaches that attract tourists. In fact, the travel and tourism industry make up some 25% of the country's gross domestic product, and in one way or another, employs more than one-third of the country's population. The success of the sector is critical for job creation and the country's long-term economic growth, writes the Millennium Challenge Corporation's program officer for Cape Verde, Benjamin Edwards, in a recent blog post. But Cape Verde has a problem: lack of water. Many Cape Verdeans have no access to public water and sanitation. In fact, the water and sanitation infrastructure on some islands is straining to accommodate a rising population and increasing tourist traffic. That is why the Millennium Challenge Corporation stepped up to help in 2005 and again in 2012. The MCC, as it is known, is a bilateral, independent U.S. foreign aid agency that provides well-performing countries with large-scale grants to fund country-led solutions for reducing poverty through sustainable economic growth. MCC stresses accountability, good governance and transparency, as well as country-led solutions and their implementation. In 2005, and then again in 2012, the MCC signed five-year compacts with the government of Cape Verde worth $110 million and $66 million, respectively. Much of the funding concerned water management. The 2012 compact, among other things, helped fund infrastructure and capital improvements in the water and sanitation sector. This year, even as the second compact nears its end, the government of Cape Verde is bringing online the Santa Maria Wastewater Treatment Plant on the arid island of Sal. The MCC-funded rehabilitation of the plant expands water and sanitation services to low-income residents. Building on the impact of its 2005 investment, writes Millennium Challenge Corporation's Edwards, MCC is supporting the government of Cape Verde in strengthening its institutions to improve water and sanitation services for its citizens, unleash the tourism industry's full potential, and help people lift themselves out of poverty.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.